battling over the oil in Iraq. Today, Friday, June 20th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Iraq's biggest oil refinery is under assault. It could be a big prize for either side or a big loss.
It took 7 years to build it, and it may be ruined in a week.
We'll hear how the battle for oil is going in Iraq, plus how images from the war there can be surprising.
You know, it's hot there, so people are wearing, you know, slip-on sandals as they head out to war.
A war photographer's unique perspective on Iraq. And later, it's been 2 years since Julian Assange took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. One of my BBC colleagues describes meeting him there.
They didn't exactly shout, "Julian, there's someone to see you," but it had that kind of, you kind of expect him to turn up with a baseball mitt in one hand. It was that kind of atmosphere.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Yeah, military advisors are nice, but how about some airstrikes, too? That seems to be the memo today from Iraq to the White House. The Iraqi government is asking for U.S. airstrikes to help stop the advance of the Sunni militant group ISIS. Those insurgents have taken control of much of northern Iraq, and apparently they're getting ready for a new assault on Iraq's biggest oil refinery. ISIS fighters came close to taking control of the site after a first attack that forced the refinery to shut down. Ben Lando edits the Iraq Oil Report, and he's in Erbil in northern Iraq. He says the effects of the shutdown are already being felt there.
Well, we're seeing lines for the petrol stations going, you know, miles long here in Erbil, the capital of the Kurdistan region, and we're getting reports of that throughout the northern parts of the country, all these places where this refinery, the Beji refinery, used to service. It's been offline for about a week now. It accounts for about 320,000 barrels a day of refining capacity, so that's about a third of Iraq's refining capacity that's now offline. So there's no direct threat to oil production in the oil fields, including the ones that the big international oil companies are developing, but it is taking its toll on the domestic access to gasoline.
So what would it mean exactly if insurgents could seize and control the Beji refinery?
They would have to get oil to it. The refinery is worthless if there's no oil to it. They have control over areas where there are oil fields, and they could connect it, turning some oil fields on and producing it and sending the oil by pipeline to the refinery. But it's very strategic, and I don't think that the Iraqi government would allow that to happen. We're seeing that there already is fighting at the refinery itself. There's damage to the refinery. We don't know exactly how much, but we're looking at satellite imagery that shows smoke coming from it and at least some of the storage tanks, some oil and some fuel runoff that's been set on fire by some of the fighting. And so it went from a stalemate where both sides agreed not to take the battle into the refinery, and now we're seeing that there is now fighting at the refinery itself, and this could cause massive damage. It took 7 years to build it, and it may be ruined in a week.
So why actually seize an oil refinery? I mean, is it the thing that's going to make them independent in Iraq?
Yes and no. They also see it as a way to make money. I mean, this refinery, back from 2003 until about 2007, somewhere between a third to almost three-quarters of the fuel was being smuggled. This was funding al-Qaeda operations in Iraq. 2007, the Iraqi government and the U.S. government went in there, arrested the leadership, installed new leadership that really turned that refinery around. And now we're seeing it take a few steps backwards, you could say. So this refinery is known to groups as being a cash cow of sorts. And so that money, you know, can go a long way, whether it's to funding, you know, militant operations or getting fuel to residents to buy sympathy or even handing out cash itself.
I'm just curious, where are most of the oil fields located?
Iraq has oil and gas fields almost everywhere, but the ones that we're seeing that are being developed, that are producing oil, most of it is in the south. In Basra province, 80% of the oil production is there, 100% of the exports by the central government goes through Basra province out to the Gulf. So that's as furthest away from the fighting as you probably could get. And there's also oil fields being developed by the autonomous Kurdistan region in the very far north. But there's a pretty big Kurdish military presence preventing anything from spilling over.
Can you imagine a scenario in which insurgents seize this refinery in Beji, but they're unable to get oil into it? I mean, then what happens?
Yeah, that's definitely a scenario. It would be difficult for them to continuously operate as if they were a state. There are way too many actors, not only in Iraq, but the United States, Europe, that doesn't want to see an insurgent group have their own state, and they wouldn't let them have an oil sector. That's for sure.
Do you think the Iraqi government in Baghdad is worried? I mean, what would the loss of a major refinery like Beji mean for an already weakened government?
Well, I don't think they would let it be lost. I think that they control it or nobody will have it. And that's what will happen. And I don't know if they're worried as much as they are just angry about how things are going down. And this is going to mean, you know, spending $4 to $7 billion to build another refinery. That's the way it's looking right now.
That's Ben Lando in Erbil. He edits the Iraq Oil Report. Some blame the whole Iraq crisis on one man, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. His critics accuse his Shiite-dominated government of shutting out other factions like Sunnis and Kurds. Maliki disagrees. Here's the Prime Minister speaking through an interpreter.
We are telling them this is the Iraqi people. It will not be defeated. It will not give in. Iraq is united with its Sunnis, Shia, Kurds, and Arabs.
Earlier today, I spoke with Zuhair al-Nahar. He's in London, but he's a spokesman for Nouri al-Maliki's political party. I asked him if Maliki has any plans to give in to his critics and step down.
This is something for the Iraqi politicians to decide, the Iraqi people, the allies of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. What is clear is that he has managed to gain a large number of votes in the elections that we've just had. He had three times more than his nearest rival in personal votes. And his parliamentary bloc managed to gain almost 90 seats, which is three times more than its nearest rival. So the constitution cannot be bypassed.
How did that voting result break down in terms of Sunni and Shia?
In other
words, how much support does Nouri al-Maliki have from the Sunni community?
Well, I mean, most of the provinces, unfortunately, in Iraq are based on sectarian basis. He managed to get the majority from the Shia provinces, but then the Shia provinces are the biggest and have the largest population. He has actually, he ran his campaign on a platform of forming a majority government where all sectors of the Iraqi community are present and are influential.
If you're using a vote, though, in which it sounds like mostly Shia voted for Nouri al-Maliki, I mean, that's not a big surprise. Isn't that fact alone? Doesn't that just illustrate how polarized Iraq is right now?
Well, yes. No one wants to see a polarized Iraq. But that is the reality that we have. We are trying to develop that and to improve that.
How? And can you tell us specifically? Because that seems to be the root of the problem, if you can
figure that
out.
The most important thing is to focus on the Iraqi identity rather than a sectarian or a party identity. And Prime Minister Maliki has said time and time again, his latest interview and his latest speech to the Iraqi people, he said, do not say Shia and Sunni, say Iraqi. The Iraqi nationality is what is common between all.
I mean, words are great, you know, to say words like unity, but how do you actually pull people together? And how do you stop the fighting?
Well, I mean, this is a long process. It's a process of education. It's not a process that can be done overnight. The polarization occurred because Saddam had polarized the whole of Iraq. And this is going to take many, many years to undo.
What did you think of President Obama's words yesterday on Iraq?
I think they were a step in the right direction. He obviously realizes the gravity of the situation. His offer to send 300 experts is welcomed and, as I said, is a step in the right direction to focus the strategic efforts of the Iraqi army. But we are hoping that once he sees the need, or these experts see the need for more effective strikes against the centers of these terrorists, then that will be the next step.
Zuhair al-Nahar is a spokesperson for Nouri al-Maliki's political party, the Islamic Dawah Party. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Photojournalist Rita Leissner covered the opening days of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and she returned to Iraq three more times since then. We reached her in Toronto, and I asked her to share her thoughts on the rapid advance by Sunni insurgents in Iraq's north.
Let me just describe a little bit what it was like when I first went into Iraq in April in 2003. So I actually walked into Iraq from Turkey. I was helped into the country by Kurdish smugglers. And then I made my way to Baghdad by meeting people on the street and hopping in taxis and leapfrogging from city to city. You know, Mosul was among the cities. Mosul, which as you know, we know recently fell to ISIS. Mm. You know, I arrived in Mosul shortly after it had fallen to the Americans and also shortly after Tikrit had fallen to the Americans.
Yeah, so where has your mind gone to as you've realized that these places that we were in with U.S. troops embedded with them are now part of ISIS?
Well, it's horrifying. I'm thinking a lot about the people that I met. Many of the people that I befriended in Iraq left the country, but of course, most have remained behind. And I think about them. And when I see, you know, pictures of, you know, now many volunteer army members, and you see all these people in civilian clothing, and we know that, you know, ordinary citizens are like showing up in droves to volunteer. They're wearing civilian clothes. I mean, half the time they're only wearing sandals. I mean, you know, it's hot there. So people are wearing, you know, slip-on sandals as they head out to war. You know, in the next frame, you see pictures of some of these people in the backs of trucks, you know, being carted off like cattle, which, you know, the idea of people in trucks and trains, of course, conjures up so many horrific images. And it's unimaginable the kind of horror that they must be feeling about the uncertainty and the unknown. And indeed, we know that many of them are just being carted off to be executed.
I got to say, it's really intense to hear you as a photojournalist kind of speak visually about all of this right now. I'm just wondering, is there one photo or one moment during your time documenting the scene in Iraq where it kind of became obvious to you just how on a razor's edge the country was situated and that the future was certainly going to be difficult?
I'll give you a strange image. When we decided that we wanted to cover the siege of Najaf, the road between Baghdad and Najaf was so dangerous that in a two-week period, six of our colleagues were kidnapped and two were murdered, you know, and yet we still took this road. We went to Najaf with many Arab journalists and Iraqi journalists and managed somehow to broker a ceasefire, a half-day ceasefire, so that we could go into the shrine and interview the Mahdi fighters. And as our convoy approached the shrine, which was, it was almost an hour drive at a snail's pace, passing checkpoints and, you know, having American tanks in the distance that we could only see with binoculars, like giving us the nod to go ahead, and then Mahdi army fighters letting us pass. And then as we got closer and closer to the sign, we could see all these armed figures emerging from behind pillars from amidst the rubble and the dust and the hot, hot sun. And we could see they were allowing us to come in, and we had our hands raised up. And some of us were holding, you know, white sheets of paper above our heads because, you know, I guess white is supposed to protect you from being shot. And as we walked close to the shrine, the soldiers started chanting. And I turned to one of the interpreters from the London Telegraph, and I said, "What are they saying? What are they chanting?" And he said, "They're chanting the song that says, 'Don't kill the journalists.'"
Rita Leissner, an artist, war photographer, and lecturer at the University of Toronto. Her latest book is Looking for Marshall McLuhan in Afghanistan. Rita, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Rita is sharing with us some of the pictures from the Iraq War she took 10 years ago. See what's changed and what hasn't at PRI.org. Still to come on The World, the World Cup play-by-play in Spanish can be colorful to some, offensive to others on PRI, Public Radio International. The news out of Iraq is dominating headlines in many places around the globe. A different crisis is captivating people in Israel. It's a search for three Israeli teenagers who went missing last week. Israel says they were abducted by Hamas militants, and that sparked Israel's biggest offensive against Hamas in the West Bank in more than a decade. But there's a parallel offensive happening online. Daniel Estrin reports on that from Tel Aviv.
Even before local media reported that the Israeli teenagers were apparently abducted, the rumors were making the rounds. A dozen university student activists, leaders of pro-Israel student advocacy groups, started chatting on WhatsApp, brainstorming ideas for a campaign. When the news hit the Israeli media, they were ready to pounce.
Within 32 minutes, we had all of the Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We had the research guys going. We had graphics guys already ready with things to be uploaded.
Israeli activist Emily Nielsen is one of the student organizers. Their hashtag campaign, Bring Back Our Boys. Remember when everyone was posing with signs saying Bring Back Our Girls after Boko Haram kidnaps Nigerian schoolgirls? That's the inspiration.
This isn't about Nigerians or Israelis or something specific happened in Israel. This is about terrorists are kidnapping kids.
The Bring Back Our Boys campaign went viral. Matis Yahu, the American Jewish reggae rapper, tweeted a selfie with the slogan. Yesterday, Israel's first lady did the same, just like Michelle Obama did for the Nigerian girls. But like most internet memes, the slogan has started to take on a life of its own.
For those terrorists who have kidnapped our kids.
An Arab-Israeli teenager received threats from the Arab-Israeli community after he posted this YouTube video in English, Hebrew, and Arabic.
You better bring them back.
He sides with Israel instead of with the Palestinians, as the Arab community in Israel tends to do. Meanwhile, Palestinians have appropriated the Bring Back Our Boys hashtag to call attention to Palestinian boys arrested by Israel. And some Palestinians are posting photos holding up three fingers to support the capture of the three Israeli teens in hopes that they can be traded for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, like the prisoner exchanged 3 years ago with captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. This Palestinian song on YouTube celebrates the kidnapped teens as three Shalits. A lot of the online content is coming directly from here, the Israeli army's social media headquarters. 40 young officers churn out infographics, blog posts, and videos 24/7. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner heads the unit in Tel Aviv.
There's a vibe here, like a college dorm room and an advertising agency.
We're a bit of both, but at the end of the day, we're the military. We are about getting the message out, so...
Two soldiers are writing English captions for a YouTube video of a nighttime raid at an office that broadcasts Hamas TV.
This is Hamas's official channel. Okay. Our objective is to close their offices.
Another soldier named Tamara was working on a Spanish language blog post about Hamas's civilian institutions. Some might call this unit a propaganda machine. Tamara says it's about fighting for public opinion.
I believe there's two battlefields. The first one is the actual battlefield, and the second one is in the internet.
Since the Israeli teens went missing last week, Israel has arrested more than 300 Palestinians, including some prominent politicians, and raided sites affiliated with the Hamas militant group. Israeli leaders say the military offensive is just beginning. And just like the Nigerian girls kidnapped by Boko Haram, the Israeli boys have not yet been found. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin, Tel Aviv.
Time can go by really slowly when you're waiting for something to happen. Just ask Julian Assange. The WikiLeaks founder this week marks 2 years of staying inside Ecuador's embassy in London. He sought refuge there to avoid extradition to Sweden, where he still faces allegations of sexual misconduct. Ecuador's foreign minister says Assange can stay for as long as necessary. So for now, Assange continues to live in a cramped office building. And that got us wondering, what's that like? Our producer in London, Leo Hornack, just happens to have been to the Ecuadorian embassy in London. You were part of a production team that met Assange, Leo. So tell us where the embassy is, first of all, in the city.
Hi, Marco. Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty surreal, strange experience. You're in one of the most expensive, kind of luxurious parts of London near Harrods in Kensington. And it's a kind of pretty anonymous street, except in the middle of that street, there's a whole bunch of armed police with assault rifle standing at, looking a bit bored on the street corner, which is not the normal kind of thing you expect in a kind of sunny, high-class London street.
So you get inside. What happens next? When do you actually meet Assange, and what kind of room is he in?
Well, you go through the front door. You know, you have this moment where there's a sort of reception desk. And I don't know if you remember when you were a kid and you're sort of going around for a play date with a friend. You know, there's that moment where you go and knock on their parents' door and you say, you know, hey, is Marco in? and Marco comes down the stairs with, you know, ready for the afternoon. And it right. felt a bit like that. We went in, we said, you know, we're here to see Julian. And there was a kind of moment, they didn't exactly shout, "Julian, there's someone to see you." But it had that kind of, you kind of expect him to turn up with a baseball mitt in one hand. It was that kind of atmosphere that he was in charge. He was the person we're coming to see, but he wasn't really sort of his own man in that house.
What was he like?
There's a very strange aura to Julien Assange, and it's strange in person as well as on the TV. It's this strange mix of sort of statesmanlikeness, which you can see he's striving for, and he kind of achieves, but at the same time, at the edge, there's this sort of slight anxiety, this slight kind of mischievousness at the same time, and nervousness that is kind of buzzing around him. So he would walk down the stairs, walk into the room, surrounded by these kind of WikiLeaks volunteers, very young volunteers, very enthusiastic, and he would sort of stride in, but he would be kind of glancing around at the corners, kind of just trying to assess the impression he was making, or at least that was how I felt it was. So there's this tension between someone who is very keen to be the centre of events, very keen to be taken seriously, but who's also kind of an insecure at the same time.
How does he pass the time in the Ecuadorian embassy? I mean, dare I ask you, does he spend a lot of time online?
Well, I would assume so, but I really couldn't say. I mean, we didn't see inside his personal kind of rooms. But in that building, there's a strange kind of double sense. Just as I was saying, there's a sort of statesmanlikeness, but also an anxiety and a nervousness and an insecurity. Mm. You could feel that in the room that we met him in for this meeting, this interview. It, on the one hand, was this quite kind of ambassadorial room. There was this big polished table, as you would picture in the inside of an embassy. And Julian was seated at a formal table there, sat kind of straight-backed, looking everyone in the eye, you know. At the same time, just behind him, there was sort of faded tourism posters for Ecuador, and you know, there were kind of a dusty, discarded old 10-year-old computer and a computer printer on the floor, and it was all a bit kind of sort of chaotic and messy, and to me that sort of summed up the strangeness of the whole situation, because on the one hand we were talking to someone who was absolutely at the center of world affairs, but on the other hand, we're talking to someone who has absolutely no control over their own environment.
Yeah, it's kind of surreal. Quite the assignment, Leo. Leo Harnack is our London-based producer. Leo, thanks for telling us the story.
Not at all, Marco. Thanks.
Part refuge, part self-imposed house arrest. I'm sure above all, it just gets boring for Assange. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, an immigrant from Ghana remembers what it was like calling home in the old days.
If you wanted to make a call, you had to write him a letter and let him know when you are going to call somebody.
And later,
here he comes.
Our friend Izzy the Ocelot picks a winner for the next U.S. World Cup match. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. What I do every day is not a dangerous job, unless you count cycling through Boston to get to the office. But in many places around the globe, journalists do face grave dangers. We're going to focus on one of those places right now, Pakistan. Journalists there are facing more and more restrictions on what they can report or comment on. Political cartoonists, too, they're feeling the heat, maybe more so than writers, because some hardline interpreters of the Quran believe it's blasphemous to draw certain animals or represent a real person. And many Pakistani editors are complying with hardliners' demands out of fear. The World's Carol Hill says more.
If you're a political cartoonist, your job is to comment on the news happening around you. But in Pakistan, that's hard at the moment. In fact, it's downright dangerous.
I mean, it was really very difficult to make cartoons on issues like extremism or militancy in Pakistan, or even about the judiciary and the army. So there's a very limited space to work at this moment in Pakistan.
That's Sabir Nazar. He's been a political cartoonist for 24 years, but right now is possibly the low point in his professional career. In January, men armed with pistols and silencers killed three of his colleagues in Karachi. The Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility. In March, Nazar came to Washington for a fellowship at the National Endowment for Democracy. He says in retrospect, the timing was a blessing.
When I came to Washington, immediately after 1 or 2 months, the attack on journalists started.
The offices of Nazar's paper, the Express Tribune, have been attacked 6 times over the past few months. The paper was founded in 2010 to push the boundaries of Pakistani journalism, meaning it reported on terrorism and Muslim extremism, and even waded into issues like the country's gay community. But after the attacks, the editor changed the paper's policy. Henceforth, no criticism of militant groups or religious parties. No criticism of terrorist attacks. No criticism of the Pakistani army. And don't even think about commenting on Pakistan's wide-ranging blasphemy law, something extremists have used to justify their attacks. Sabr Nazar totally understands why his editor buckled under the pressure, but he won't change what he draws.
I don't believe in self-censorship because that restricts your space even more. So I make whatever I feel like, and I would leave it to the editor if he feels that it's not publishable. But I am not going to reject any idea because, you know, it looks dangerous or anything to me.
So a lot of his cartoons are rejected. Sabr Nazar is deeply frustrated. He believes Pakistan's leaders are tiptoeing around the issue of religious extremism instead of confronting it head-on. Nazar says the strategy of occasional airstrikes on suspected insurgent bases in Waziristan is about as effective as a game of whack-a-mole. The extremists simply show up elsewhere, as they did recently in Karachi with 2 deadly attacks on the airport that killed 36 people. And Nazar has drawn withering cartoons, some of them rejected, about the strategy of Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who wants to negotiate with the militants. So far, there's been only 1 round of direct talks between the government and the Pakistani Taliban, and with the airport attacks, that strategy is likely to go on hold. Nazar says where Pakistanis have really deluded themselves is in thinking that it's only a tiny minority who hold extremist views.
A lot of people, you know, they believe that it's a small minority that's extremist who are actually doing this. And I once wrote a satirical column and I said, well, yes, it's a small minority. Majority is peaceful and moderate. But the most popular name in Pakistan is Osama.
Nazar says of the past 10 or 15 years, he's seen the cultural space in Pakistan narrow, the way it did in Afghanistan under the Taliban.
Kite flying is banned in Lahore. I mean, if you remember, that's what they did in Kabul. So, I mean, I see a lot of similarities with that.
Roadside billboards are often covered over with black paint. Dancing and certain types of music are now banned on college campuses. And in his hometown of Peshawar, Nazar can no longer sit outside and draw. It's considered un-Islamic. Sabr Nazar wants to restore the power and beauty of the visual arts in Pakistan. He believes they can actually contribute to a more tolerant, liberal society. He's using his fellowship in Washington to go through the more than 5,000 cartoons he's drawn over his career. The result will be a cartoon history of the last quarter century in Pakistan. Sabr Nazar's fellowship ends in August. He's not sure what he'll do next. If the situation in Pakistan remains dangerous for cartoonists and journalists, he may stay away a bit longer. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
Let's turn our attention now to the World Cup. Major excitement over the games in Brazil, all over the globe. How much excitement? Well, let me play you the sound from a YouTube video I happen to see. It's shot from a skyscraper in downtown Santiago, Chile, at the exact moment that Chile's team scored a goal thousands of miles away in Rio. You'll hear it. Yeah, pretty clear how folks in Santiago felt about Chile scoring against colonial masters Spain that day. I'm not sure you'd hear the same roar over Washington or New York after a U.S. goal, but who knows, you might. Seems more and more people in the U.S. are tuning in to watch World Cup games on TV, many of them on the Spanish-language Univision Network. That's what Felix Sanchez is doing. Sanchez is co-founder of the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts. And though he's primarily an English speaker, he decided to watch the games on Univision to catch the commentary. But he was surprised by what he heard.
Univision is trouncing ESPN in the ratings, and part of that reason is that English-language-leaning Latinos like myself join for more authentic experience with Univision, but sometimes we get surprised by some of the things we hear.
Like what?
Most recently was characterization related to an Afro-Costa Rican player, describing him not by his last name, but by the color of his skin, calling him Moreno. It was alarming at first.
You also wrote on Facebook about other terms that you heard on Univision, like greña. Can you just kind of explain their meaning to non-Spanish speakers like myself?
Greña really means kind of messy hair, but some individuals think of it as referring to African-American hair and also describing it as nappy hair. Mm. When English language-leaning Latinos watch Spanish language programming, there is a culture clash that occurs because the kind of social progress that we live in our mainstream world, doesn't always seem as reflected in programming that is not English language programming.
So how do these words then kind of get perceived in Latin America, like in South America?
I think they are very comfortable with the use of these kinds of descriptors. And therein lies kind of the issue, which is that regardless of the fact that it's being broadcast in Spanish, it's still by a U.S. broadcaster that must abide by American standards and American sensibilities. Now, the good news to all of this was that the president of Univision Sports reached out to me. There have been no other incidents that I have heard or that anyone has relayed to me. And I think that they were extremely sensitive at wanting to address these kinds of occurrences because they recognize that the audience that has tuned in, some 42 million actually since their beginning coverage, that many of them are, as I said, English language leaning Latinos who might see or feel or experience things differently, even if it's in another language.
Felix, let's just think for a moment about language, style, and cultural context, because I don't want to defend ethnic slurs in any way, but the way in which language is used when talking about soccer, I mean, it's very distinctive. It's a style, and one that, honestly, the American commentators just don't have. The Brits, oddly, get a bit more excited than our soccer commentators, but the Spanish speakers are the best, even if you don't understand them. Do you really want to water down the style and make it just like, you know, our bland American commentary?
Well, that's an interesting question. We don't want to minimize, we don't want to maximize either what's occurred because most of it has not continued. But it shows you the challenges that we have. For those of us who look at image construction, words matter. Univision responds instantly because they want this audience and they recognize that there has to be adjustments linguistically because we're not necessarily in the same worlds. We're one foot in each world.
So now that you've got a little iota of World Cup fever, who are you rooting for, Felix?
Well, I'll be rooting for USA, and I'll be rooting for Mexico.
Felix Sanchez directs the National Hispanic Foundation for the Arts. Felix, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The next U.S. match at the World Cup, by the way, is on Sunday against Portugal, so you know what that means. Yep, time for Izzy's next pick. Izzy is our World Cup predicting ocelot, and we think this tropical wildcat is uniquely qualified to pick the winner of Sunday's clash in the rainforest city of Manaus. We sent the world's Nina Porzuki to the rainforest at Boston's Franklin Park Zoo again to record his choice.
I'm standing in front of Izzy's enclosure, waiting for him to make his pick. There are two bamboo bushes ready, one USA, one Portugal. You know the drill. And then he saunters out. Warning, I'm finding it hard to be an objective reporter here.
Oh, here he comes. Just kind of staring at things, and he is going straight to Portugal.
Izzy, why? Why don't you ever want the U.S. to win?
But please, we're at the whims of an ocelot. Not exactly scientific.
Wait. He turns and leaves the Portugal bamboo. Could this be a first goal for Portugal?
He rounds a log and there he goes, and he is sniffing, and he is eating the U.S. He's definitely into it.
So into it, in fact, that after gorging on the U.S., he puked. I'll spare you the sound. So what's this all mean? Well, Janine Jackal, his keeper, was pretty confident.
He took a little taste of Portugal and then moved right on to USA, and that's where he's staying. So, looks like USA right now.
As for Izzy's obsession with bamboo, I was curious.
Janine, what exactly does the bamboo do for him?
There's different theories on it. Maybe it helps his digestion. You know, if he should have hairballs or something, it'll help him remove the hairballs.
So he gets hairballs too?
Yes, he does, yeah. It's normal, and all cats seem to like to eat grass and plants.
So there you have it, folks. He nipped at Portugal, he overindulged on the U.S., and then he puked. Or in Izzy speak, Portugal scores early, and then it's a U.S. onslaught. Izzy believes that we will win, or something. For the world, I'm Nina Porzucchi, in the tropical rainforest at the Franklin Park Zoo in Boston.
Wow, I wonder if lions get hairballs too. Tell Izzy what you think. He tweets. Yes, I said he tweets at Izzy Picks. That's IZZY PICKS. Wildcats these days and their social media handlers. Okay, so the last time Izzy made a prediction, it was Ghana over the U.S. He was wrong. The U.S. won. But that game must have been a case of divided loyalties for Abu Egan. He's a Silicon Valley engineer who came to the U.S. from Ghana. That was in 1979. As part of our First Days project, we asked Abu to share some of his earliest memories of life in America. And one of them was how he first kept in touch with family back home.
Nowadays, it's very easy to call, Skype, all over the place. But in those days, it was very difficult. Telecommunication in Ghana was very, very backward. If you wanted to make a call, you had to write them a letter and let them know when you are going to call somebody. I will actually sit down and compose what I wanted to tell them, you know, point by point, and then go through it, and then make a 30-minute tape and mail the tape to them. And then they will sometimes do the same and also send it to us. Most of the time, my mom sent me a tape. She was complaining. By this time in Ghana, you know, the early 80s, the coup that happened in 79 had really taken over. I mean, there were sanctions against the country, and they were really, really struggling. And there was also drought just to mix it in. And she didn't understand why it's taking me so long to, you know, finish school. Why don't I finish and start something? So that people are suffering. When am I coming back? Those are the things that stuck in my mind. It's like, when can I finish and go help them up? And also, before I left, I met one of my nephews who is a DJ. And he asked me, are you taking along any Ghanaian music? And I said, what would I need that for? I mean, most of the good music is out there. He said, no, you are going to be needing them. So he made me some tapes, you know, mixtapes. There is one specific song that I used to play and cry, you know. The song is Obidishie by J.A. Adolfo and his City Boys. And it's about a prince in a strange kingdom. You know, when a prince travels to somebody's land, they can easily become a servant. And so this song is just saying that a tributary of a big river, you know, is regarded as a slave to that river. And so in Chi, they will call it the Obidishie Akwaye Baby Akwa. And I'm here in the U.S., even though I knew there was going to be a payback somewhere down the line. But in the meantime, I was just struggling through this whole situation. And that song always reminded me about that. Even today, when I hear that, it just brings a little bit of tears into my eyes sometimes.
Abu Egan, who came to the U.S. from Ghana in 1979. Share your First Day story with us. Just head to pri.org/firstdays. This is The World on PRI Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Back to Iraq now.
It's just heartbreaking, I think.
Blake Hall served in Iraq in 2006 and 2007 in Mosul and in Baghdad, among other places, with a striker brigade out of Fort Lewis in Washington State. He led a reconnaissance and sniper unit that went after insurgents. Nowadays, Hall runs a tech company in Washington, D.C., and he's been following the news from Iraq closely. That's been frustrating, he says, and as we heard, heartbreaking.
It's incredibly tough. In Mosul, I lost friends in Mosul. We lost Iraqi interpreters who fought with us in Mosul. To see all of the gains that we had established and the opportunity for stability, you know, wiped away is incredibly frustrating.
I mean, you run a tech company now in Washington, D.C. How do you kind of like talk about this with, you know, people who you used to serve with, people who know what was invested in places like Mosul?
One of the dilemmas that combat veterans face is that no one can really understand your experience. Even if you're able to articulate the trauma that you experienced and the sacrifice that you saw, you would still never quite get across the true reality of those experiences. And so that's, you know, something that I think all of us have to live with. It's a bit isolating. At the same time, I've kept current with the politics in Iraq, and it's a little bit frustrating to see the level of naivety that still exists within, you know, the public discourse, as some of the same talking heads who are wrong about Iraq from the beginning continue to shape the narrative about Iraq, and that's really what's put us in the situation where, you know, after 13 years of warfare, not only is Iraq not a more stable place and not a country that is in the best interests of American national security, but quite the opposite, where our arch enemy, al-Qaeda, now has a safe haven.
When you say talking heads, you mean people from the Bush administration?
Yeah. You know, and I don't want to politicize it because, to me, I'm a soldier, and so... But I think a lot of the folks who advocated for war, and most of them happen to be in the Bush administration, you know, are still talking now about how the Obama administration has messed up the situation. But to me, I think it's just been a consistent failure by both administrations throughout the course of our experience in Iraq. The only difference really is, you know, in order of magnitude, where I think the administration who started the war bears the majority of the blame, but we certainly never had a coherent strategy for Iraq, in my opinion. And, you know, it's just tough to kind of live with that on a day-to-day experience and not to have other people understand you.
And now see what's going on in Iraq
right. Again. Yep.
Blake, let's dig into the situation right now in Iraq. I mean, maybe you can help us understand some of what's going on there. But we've heard, first of all, that ISIS is picking up former soldiers and Sunni higher-ups, commanders from Saddam Hussein's days.
Mm-hmm.
Is that believable to you? I mean, maybe you can tell us how you assessed loyalties when you were there.
I think so. I wouldn't be surprised if Ezzet Al-Douri, who is the you know, key lieutenant of Saddam Hussein and escaped to Syria. He was one of the few guys in the deck of cards who wasn't captured. Ultimately played a leading role in coordinating the collapse of the Iraqi army and the rapid sweep of ISIS militants into northern Iraq. But, you know, if you were a Sunni Arab, you literally had no incentive to be part of the new Iraq. That was incredibly frustrating while I was on the ground fighting over there, because even as we were targeting these groups, the level of violence and the reason it was so high was directly related to the political disenfranchisement of the Sunnis. And so having said all of that, because of what General Petraeus did over there, he actually established an opportunity for the Maliki administration and for Iraq to have a shot at long-term political reconciliation. But the Americans ultimately backed Maliki, and Maliki has just been pretty staunchly sectarian and has shown a lot of allegiance to the Iranians.
Blake, there are a lot of nerves and anxiety in Baghdad right now. Can you describe for us what it feels like to be in Baghdad, a city of mixed Shia and Sunni people, many more different sects? Can you imagine what it's like there right now with a sectarian civil war kind of pressing down upon them?
You know, when I was there, I've never felt emotions like I felt when I was on combat patrols in Baghdad, and macabre is one way to really describe it. And there's just always an atmosphere of fear. You know, we would see corpses by the side of the road, and it felt like the city was dying when I was there in 2007, from January through September, is when we were in Baghdad. So, you know, when I think about Baghdad, what's really concerning is that city is now divided along pretty stark lines between Sunni, Shia, and then, you know, you might have some pockets where the Sunni are surrounded by different Shia communities. I just think it's incredibly unfortunate, because the average Iraqi family is going to be caught in the middle of all of these forces. And when I think about a neighborhood like Dora, which is Sunni and right in the middle of Baghdad, as these militants come closer and the Shia, you know, begin to radicalize and to kind of take up arms, those folks are at pretty high risk for being targeted as part of a, you know, a genocide type of campaign. So It's tough because you form relationships over there with families. And so now to know that they're at risk and that the country is, it might be even more divided after this particular episode is just heartbreaking, I think.
Blake Hall, a former U.S. Army captain with the 3rd Stryker Brigade out of Fort Lewis, Washington. Thanks so much for your time and your thoughts today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Marco.
Not long before the time of the first Gulf War, a baby girl was born in Kuwait City. Remember Kuwait, the country Saddam Hussein invaded to trigger that war in 1990? Now, all these years later, that girl I mentioned is grown. Alanoud Al-Omran, who goes by Nadi, is one of 2 front vocalists for the Brighton, UK band House of Hats. Their CD, This Love, just came out. It's pretty sweet. And they're touring the U.S. right now. Nadi shares vocal duties on the album with guitarist and pianist Alex Gigante, but here Nadi takes the lead on a track whose title I think we can all relate to, Home is Where the Heart Is. Her sound is a long way from Kuwait. House of Hats with their tune Home is Where the Heart Is. And that's a wrap for us today. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You all have a great weekend. Home is where the heart is.